Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Building an Effective Child Welfare Training System conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Susan Kanak. Ms. Kanak, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. Welcome, everyone. I'm Susan Kanak, representing the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, also known as the NRCOI. The NRCOI is part of a network of national resource centers and organizations funded by the Children's Bureau, Department of Health and Human Services, to provide technical assistance to child welfare agencies and tribes across the country. Today's teleconference focuses on strategies for building effective child welfare training systems. In a few minutes, we'll hear from folks who recently interviewed child welfare training managers, trainers, and university partners across the country to identify the components of an effective child welfare training system and to try to understand how these systems grow and develop. We have more than 146 individuals and agencies registered for this call, so obviously we can't do a roll call, but on the line and joining us throughout the call, we have representatives from the following: state and county child welfare agencies, ACF regional offices, universities, provider agencies, and other national resource centers. I welcome all of you, and I'm so glad you took the time from your busy schedules to join us on this important conversation. Let me take a few minutes on logistics. We've reserved the last 15 minutes of this teleconference for questions and discussion. So please jot down any comments or questions you have, and once the lines open up, we'll be happy to answer them. We hope that we can have some dialogue at the end of this discussion. And finally, this call is being taped and will be available for downloading within a day or two from the NRCOI website where many of you registered, and that is www.nrcoi.org. Okay, let me now introduce our presenters for today's call. Susan Masiolik, who is sitting in the room here with me. I'm in Portland, Maine, by the way, where it's just started to rain. Susan has spent several years as a senior manager in the Massachusetts Child Welfare Agency and is currently a consultant with the NRCOI. Susan, would you like to say hi?
Hi.
And also down in Rhode Island is Lori Hurst. Lori is a training specialist with the Rhode Island Child Welfare Institute. Lori?
Hi, everyone.
And also sitting here with Susan and I up in Portland and ready to participate as needed is Maureen Baker. Maureen also works for the Cutler Institute at the University of Southern Maine, and she is involved with both the NRCOI and the Violence Against Women Project.
Hello, everyone.
And Maureen was quite instrumental in helping us update our training system assessment guide, which we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. Here's how the call will go today. I'm going to start off giving us a bit of context to this discussion by talking about the child welfare training environment and focus on some of the factors that are currently shaping child welfare training nationally. Then Susan Masiolik will talk about the components of an effective child welfare training system and strategies for building one. Next, we'll turn to Lori, who will describe the child welfare training system in Rhode Island, talk about how it has grown and evolved over the last decade or so, and hopefully Lori will provide for us, I know she will in fact, a good case example of how you can strengthen and build an effective child welfare training system. And finally, we're going to take a couple of minutes just to talk about some technical assistance that's available to you for building an effective training system, and then we'll open up the call for your questions and comments. Before we get into the meat of the call, however, I want to take a minute and talk a little bit about one of the handouts for today's call, and that's the newly released Guide to Building Effective Training Systems for Child Welfare Agencies. That document was found on the NRCOI website, and it's available for use during this call, and also, we hope, for your review after the call. We're not going to walk you through the guide during the call today, but please do take a look at it and review it in detail. It is an update of a guide that we published in 2005, and I must say that this new guide is stocked full of recent concrete examples of effective training systems and effective training system practices from state and county child welfare agencies across the country. There are several new features in this guide. We talk a little bit about the life cycle of a training system. We've updated some of the performance principles and indicators that Susan's going to talk with us about in a few minutes. But I do think a real highlight of the guide is the examples that many of you on this call have shared with us. We developed the guide with the active participation and involvement of child welfare training directors, trainers, and university partners across the country, and it's due to them and their willingness to share their expertise, their lessons learned with us that the guide, I believe, has turned out to be the useful document that it is. So to those of you who are on the call, thank you very much for that, for sharing your information so willingly for us. Concretely, the guide presents information on how federal funding requirements support and shape training, how training systems can and should support the day-to-day work and practice of staff, supervisors, managers, partners, and stakeholders. It also has a description of the life cycle of a training system and has some very concrete discussion and examples of strategies for developing a mature training system. The guide also includes a process and a tool you can use to assess your training system, and also a training sample training system assessment workshop. We hope you'll take the time to think about how the information in this guide and what we're going to talk about in the call today can be useful to you and your agency. Okay, enough on the guide. Let me talk a little bit about the child welfare training environment as we see it. As we were talking with training managers from across the country to gather the examples for the training system assessment guide, we heard some marvelous stories about what child welfare training looked like 10 to 15 years ago. So I'd ask everybody on the call right now to take a minute just to think back when you became involved in child welfare training. What did the training look like? Was there a system? Was there curriculum? Who were the trainers? I think if you take some time to think about that, you'll find that the world of child welfare training today is very different than what it was 10 to 15 years ago. Let me give you some examples about what we learned from some training managers who have been in the field for 10 years or longer. What they told us when we talked to them is that 10 years ago, child welfare training was state or even county specific. There was lots of excellent training being offered across the country, but it was developed and delivered locally. So there was very little, if any, sharing of curriculum across states, much less nationally. The work that was being done was very county or state specific, so you could have 25 or 30 states all designing training on a particular topic and not knowing anyone else was doing that. Very little. There was some, but very little sharing of curriculum or lessons learned from curriculum. 10 years ago, we were told training primarily focused on caseworkers and foster parents. Little was done for supervisors, less was done for managers, and even less was done for other stakeholders and partners. We were told there were very few standards for curriculum development, classroom delivery, and trainer skill sets. For example, training tended to be developed by content experts, people who knew the subject matter thoroughly, but were not necessarily knowledgeable about adult learning and practiced at stand-up delivery. So they were content experts, but sometimes the delivery wasn't what it is today. Training evaluation was focused primarily on level one evaluation. That's the satisfaction level. Transfer of learning was just beginning to get attention. Training evaluation results, if they were calculated, were usually shared just with the trainers, yet few others. Manager, we were told, if there was one, was not part of senior leadership. In fact, frequently, training manager duties were divided among various personnel at lower levels. We also learned from our advisors that the role of university partners was uneven across the country. In some cases, the universities were in charge of child welfare training, and the state had a minimal role. In other cases, the opposite was true. And finally, there were few forums for child welfare trainers to come together to share good work and lessons learned. NSDTA was one of the few places where training was actually spotlighted and highlighted. Some things remain the same, but a lot has changed recently, hasn't it? For example, 15 years ago, a call like this would be a rarity if it would have happened at all. I'm going to take the next couple of minutes to talk about four drivers that we think have shaped child welfare training as it looks today, to bring it from where it was 10 to 15 years ago to where it is now. And these are national drivers. I'm sure many of these will be familiar to you. One, funding for training from the Department of Health and Human Services. Through Titles 4B and 4E funding, DHHS creates strong incentives for states to work with public universities and for public universities to support the work of the state's child welfare agency. Through Title 4E stipend programs and child welfare training grants, DHHS is intending to help state child welfare agencies develop a stable and highly skilled workforce for providing effective child welfare services. Many states supplement the federal training funds with state or private dollars, but finding ample resources and funding continues to be a challenge for training systems across the country. So one of the big drivers for why the system looks like it does today nationally is the funding that's been provided by Health and Human Services. A second factor shaping child welfare training systems is the Child and Family Services reviews. The CFSRs have required us to think about child welfare training from a systems perspective. By identifying training systems as one of the key systemic factors, the CFSR asked training directors and agency leadership to examine how the training system is integrated into an agency's overall effort to improve outcomes for children, youth, and families. In doing so, child welfare agency managers are moving from simply overseeing training programs and institutes to understanding how an effective training system can serve as a strategic management tool to help move the entire agency forward in achieving its goals and outcomes. The CFSR also gave us the opportunity to thoughtfully define a training system and reflect on how training should be interconnected with other administrative systems. Our definition of a training system is necessarily broad and comprehensive. By the way, the definition that we use of a training system is found on page 1 of the guide. To us, a training system is comprised of the people, the trainers, managers, and universities, resources, financial and technical, policies and procedures combined into a coherent whole. The purpose of the training system is to plan, provide, support, and evaluate formal and informal instruction, learning opportunities, and professional development aimed at improving agency outcomes. So thanks to the CFSR, we now have a concrete, articulated example of what a training system is. And with that definition in hand, we're now able to begin to look at and think about what makes up an effective training system. A third factor shaping child welfare training is the articulation of child welfare practice principles or a practice model. The Children's Bureau has developed several principles that indicate what they expect state, county, and tribal child welfare agencies to consider when creating practice. According to the Children's Bureau, child welfare practice should be child-focused, family-centered, you know these words, individualized to meet specific needs of children and families, designed to strengthen parental capacity, community-based, culturally responsive, outcome-oriented, and collaborative. The adaptation of a practice model based on these principles gives direction, form, and substance to child welfare training and a training system. It is vital that the training system support and align with the agency's written, articulated practice model. The last factor that I'll mention today, even though there are a lot of others that impact training, is still new, and I'm not sure we fully understand its impact yet, and that is technology. While we were talking with training managers across the country, we heard several comments about the benefits of distance learning, using technology to share not only curricula, but to jointly develop it, and conference calls, such as the one we're having today, would have been difficult 10 to 15 years ago without the technology we have today. So there'll be more to follow on the impact of technology, but it's certainly a driver now and will be in the future of child welfare training systems. I'm going to stop here and ask Susan to pick up and talk with us about the components of effective training systems and strategies to get us there.
Great. Thank you, Susan. As Susan said, a lot of what we'll talk about is in the training system assessment guide, but we're not going to walk you through it page by page, but give you some sense of how we developed it, the important pieces of content, and how we think it can be helpful to state agencies and their university partners and others in building and developing a more mature and effective training system. We started the work by focusing really on the training audiences. You know, not surprisingly, we focused first on who gets training, who should get training in an effective training system. And so we developed a series of performance principles for training to be delivered to frontline social workers or case managers, to supervisors, to managers in the agency, and to external partners and stakeholders. So let me just stop for a minute before we jump into that and tell you what we mean by performance principles and how we've given you some guidance that support those. For us, a performance principle is a comprehensive statement about the work that a training system must do well in order to be effective. And throughout our guide, what we're really talking about is an effective training system in its more mature stage of development. And I'll talk a little bit more later about the life cycle or development cycle of a training system. But what we really focused on and wanted to fully understand and describe and provide to all of you was an understanding of what an effective or mature training system looks like, what it needs to do well in order to produce the outcomes that are important to all of us. So performance principle is a comprehensive statement about that work. We spent a lot of time talking with training system colleagues across the country about what those performance principles were, should be, for those four groups of people. As Susan said, 10 years ago, training systems looked very different from what they look like today. A lot of training systems focused almost exclusively on the front line, on social workers and case managers as new hires. Most knew that they wanted to grapple with and provide some training to supervisors, managers, external partners, but over the years have struggled with that. A lot of, or some systems have developed some really interesting strategies for that, and throughout our training guide, we provide some examples of interesting innovations in delivering those, in delivering training to those audiences. But let me give you an example of what we mean by a performance principle. So a performance principle for an effective system in supporting social workers and case managers is this: the training system introduces, clarifies, and reinforces the agency's practice model. Very simple statement, and yet a very complex and comprehensive statement. One of the first things that may hit you when you hear that is that, what do we mean by practice model? That's certainly something that a lot of folks have different definitions of. What we mean by practice model is, to whatever extent your agency has articulated what practice with families should look like, it should, that should be introduced, clarified, and reinforced for the trainees, in this case the social workers and case managers. It could be case practice values. It could be guiding principles. It could be all of that, and then expressed in operational detail. Agencies have expressed their practice model at various levels of conceptual or operational detail. What we're saying here about an effective training system is whatever exists as an articulated practice model for your agency is the first performance principle for the training system. It should introduce, clarify, and reinforce your agency's practice model. Under the performance principle, we provide indicators of that. And what we mean by an indicator is that it's an indicator that sort of further specifies ways that the training system implements and acts on that particular principle. So in this case, we would suggest that a training system would provide new hire, ongoing, and specialized training in the skills and knowledge needed to understand and implement the full practice model. It would also develop and support a cadre of coaches and mentors drawn from all levels of the agency to reinforce good practice. And then further under that, we specify a number of places where one could find evidence of that effectiveness in operation. So the guide is really set up to provide a series of performance principles of what a training system looks like when it is operating at its most effective, and a series of indicators so that you can see that operationally. And as I said, we provide that for a series of training audiences at all levels of the organization. And it was important to us to include in the vision of a training system, as it was important in to our colleagues across the country, to understand training as a system, and a system that interacts with the child welfare agency at multiple levels, so that it helps support the alignment of the agency's values, mission, practice model across the frontline staff, across the supervisors, the managers, and external partners, so that everyone is holding and able to express and act on the same vision, the same principles throughout the organization, so that families, who are obviously our ultimate concern, have a coherent experience in their interaction with us, and that training, the training system's role is in part to support and promote that coherence across those audiences. So a lot of our practice principles really, our performance principles rather, express the ways in which a training system can help bring that kind of coherence to the organization, can partner with other systems in the organization to support a child welfare's interaction with families and children. We spent a lot of time really understanding what a set of good performance principles were for frontline staff, and then for supervisors. Supervisors are a key intervention point, as I'm sure you all know and work on daily. Supervisors are key leaders to frontline practice among social workers and case managers. And if there's, I think, any growth that's happened in training over the years, it's been attention to the supervisory level. And so we've really spent some time spelling out what good performance of a training system looks like as it supports those supervisors. So, for example, one of our performance principles would be that the training system supports supervisors as key intervention points for improving the interactions between administration, other internal systems, social work staff, service providers, community partners, and children and families. Obviously, that's a fairly significant role for the supervisors throughout the organization, and we see the training system as having a key role in supporting that level of staff in advancing the agency's work on a day-to-day basis. The training system, we also see the training system as engaging supervisors as partners in the development and delivery of training for workers on their team. So supervisors aren't just recipients or attendees in training sessions. They are also partners in how training gets developed and delivered for the workers who they support and supervise on their teams. The next level, and I think every training system probably delivers a degree of some training to managers, and training for managers starts to become an array of opportunities. It's not always classroom opportunities. It's a series of professional development opportunities. But the executive leadership of the Child Welfare Agency obviously is a key place for defining, communicating, clarifying, and regularly evaluating the organization's vision, mission, values, and goals, and to ensure that every staff member can really understand and deliver a single coherent message to all the partners. So the training system, an effective training system, provides all managers with training in the leadership, managerial, and operational aspects of their jobs, as well as building the skills to exemplify the practice model. There are a number of ways in which you might see that happen in a training system. A training system might be responsible for providing an orientation to the agency's vision, values, goals, and practice model. It might partner with the staff who do that as managers are promoted. The training system partners with other agency divisions to develop and support training for managers in continued professional development. So it's important for a training system to not stop at new hires, not stop at the front lines, but to really support staff as they move up from frontline staff to supervisors to managers, and to continually engage them in more and more complete ways of developing and delivering and promoting training opportunities throughout the organization. The training system, really an effective training system, really engages the management staff in the content of the training, the development of it, how it's to be delivered throughout the organization. The next target audience that we focused somewhat on, and this was, I think, one of the newer areas that we learned about, was the external partners and stakeholders. So in addition to all of the internal staff and managers that a training system supports through a series of professional development opportunities, they also help the agency engage external partners and stakeholders in helping carry the vision and mission of the child welfare work throughout its partners and stakeholders external to the organization. And, of course, key among those would be service providers, foster parents, courts, schools, sister agencies like mental health and substance abuse. And so we see an effective training system providing orientation to the agency's vision, values, and goals, helping providers and their staff build skills in meeting their obligations and participating effectively in the child welfare work in which they're partnering, and extending all of that to some extent to the sister agencies and courts and schools throughout the child welfare system. This is an area where we've seen some interesting uses of technology to extend the resources of the training system itself. Obviously, training systems, like the rest of the child welfare system, struggle with staffing and resources and have needed to find some innovative and creative ways to extend themselves and be in places where they can't be physically. So technology is an interesting way to do some virtual training, to use some online information dissemination to help support at least sharing of information with external partners and stakeholders. It's a different training experience, obviously, but there's some very interesting ways of using technology out there. So we spent some time, actually a number of years, learning from state child welfare agencies and university partners and county folks, really understanding what a good, effective training system does to support staff at all levels of the organization. As you can hear when I'm describing this, I revert to the training system should, and what I mean is an effective training system, and it is the ideal, and what we do describe quite a bit is what an effective, ideal, mature system looks like. And in our conversations, we began to explore how a training system develops and achieves that state. And so certainly the opposite of mature is not immature. The opposite of mature is an early state of development or a growth stage of development. And we really talk about it in terms of life cycle, not in terms of you're either good or you're not good. So in our work, actually at a symposium of a number of training directors and their state partners across the country, we began to explore how a state agency and its university partners can help a training system grow and develop to achieve this more effective, ideal, or mature state, understanding that development is a process, and sometimes it moves forward, and sometimes it moves backward, and sometimes things intervene to undo some accomplishments and life changes, leadership changes. And so it's a constant process of developing and building an effective training system. But we wanted to provide some guidance about how agencies could be proactive in managing their development of their training system and not simply let it happen, which happens to not just all of us in training, but all of our colleagues in many systems. Life happens, and sometimes you are at the mercy of it, of forces beyond our control. But it's important to find ways to be proactive in managing the development of the training system. And again, as we began to explore this with colleagues across the country, we found some really wonderful and powerful examples of strategies that states engaged in to advance the development of their training system. But let me talk a little bit about how we understood the life cycle of a training system. As I said, we know the way we've understood the development is that there are early stages of development, there's a growth stage, and then there's a mature stage. And sometimes one cycles backward before moving forward again. The early stage of development is like an entrepreneurial startup stage. As Susan alluded to when she talked about what things were like 10, 15 years ago, there are training units, I'm sure, who can remember what it was like when it felt like a startup, when staff were Jacks and Jills of all trades, trainers were administrative staff as well as directors, as well as leaders, as well as curriculum designers, as well as presenters. And they really did it all. Funding could be erratic at times. Often it was a year-to-year experience, not knowing quite what the next year would bring, but doing your best to figure out how to advance the work of the training system. But that early stage is a very exciting stage. It can feel very entrepreneurial, and yet it can feel somewhat shaky as well. Moving beyond that early stage into a more of a growth stage, the system becomes more stable, takes advantage of establishing some more structure, some more rules, some procedures, some standards. Often we see that training systems move from early to growth by establishing some standards and expectations for what training looks like when it is delivered, how training participants behave and prepare for participation in training, and then following training. There's a lot of interesting innovation that can happen in growth stages, new uses of technology, new approaches to curriculum, new engagement of partners in that stage to really extend the reach of the training unit, the training partner, to really build a more comprehensive training system that reaches all our audiences in the child welfare agency and beyond. A number of organizations that we've talked to have reached a mature stage in a number of areas, but not always in all areas at the same time, and I think that's important, that one can achieve a level of real effectiveness in some areas while still growing or grappling even in early stages in other areas. So in a mature stage, which is what we really were describing in the performance principles for all of those audiences, the training system is really highly functioning. It has the resources that it needs. It uses them well and effectively. And it's really aligned with the agency priorities and mission and understands and is able to evaluate the impact of its work on performance and outcomes. When you look at the guide, you'll see that there's sort of a model, almost a logic model in there, where you'll see that a lot of the structural components that really are almost inputs to a good training system become some of the drivers for moving forward to from early to growth through to maturity. So we've described the importance of management and leadership and the importance of the training director being a part of the agency's leadership team, the importance of the staff and being very clear about the training system staff, whether they're state or county employees, university partner staff, consultants or contractors, and a range of generalists and specialists to really bring all to bear that the training system needs. A mature system has the resources that it needs, but we've talked some about how resources can be, the allocation of resources becomes in a developmental phase, and so in the early stages it's catch as catch can often, but in a more mature state you see that there's not exclusive reliance, for example, on Title IV-E, that there's a mix of funding sources. And then the partnerships and policies and procedures are also important structural components. The final piece that I wanted to talk about is perhaps one of the more interesting and important pieces, I think, maybe from your perspectives. And it's really the strategies for getting from early to growth to a really mature and effective training system. And these are places where I think the examples throughout the guide are particularly helpful and effective in illustrating these. We've talked with several states who provided very helpful examples of how their training system moved forward to establish itself as an equal partner among all the other systems in the organization, systems like quality assurance, policy and practice, human resources and supervision, and financing systems, leadership systems, how they partner with all of those systems to really develop an effective, stable, mature training system. So those strategies, and I just want to share those briefly before I close, are that first, a training system evaluates its effectiveness. And as Susan alluded, 10, 15 years ago, training systems were evaluating satisfaction of participants. And that was an important first step. But now we see training systems really evaluating their impact on agency outcomes, or beginning to grapple with how a training system makes its case as an equal partner by really understanding and evaluating and demonstrating that it does, in fact, have a positive impact on the outcomes that the agency is able to achieve for children, families, that it works with, and California provided us with a really wonderful example of that. The training system, we heard consistently from many, many colleagues that a training system itself can't reach a mature stage unless the agency has a really well-defined and articulated case practice model. And so one of the strategies for helping for the training system to help itself is to help the practice and policy system develop that practice model. Training directors were very clear that it wasn't something that they saw their responsibility as doing, but they were important partners in the development of a practice model that they then could provide training and professional development on the model and coaching on it in its implementation in the field. So that's been a very important strategy that a number of organizations have used to advance the training system's work itself. Partnering with the quality assurance and quality improvement system to receive critical feedback about practice, about the impact of training, helps the training system continually reflect on its own effectiveness, in addition to the more formal evaluation, reflect on what the state of practice is in the field, so we can perhaps develop new training opportunities that respond to some of what is being learned through the QA and QI system for the organization. All of those speak to the role of a training system as an equal system in partnership with the QA system, the case practice system. None of that is possible unless the training director, him or herself, is viewed as a member of the leadership team. So the training system, in an effective training system, and for a training system to be effective, the director needs to be a member of the agency's senior leadership team and contribute to not just deliberations about training, but deliberations about the rest of the organization's work, so that training can be supportive in promoting that work and delivering its contribution to the achievement of the agency's goals. And so we've learned a lot and provide some guides about how training directors are effective members of that leadership team. And finally, the notion that an effective training system has some access to resources, but also finds creative ways to use the resources that it has perhaps dedicated classroom space, is using technology in creative ways to extend its reach to a variety of audiences, to engage people more effectively, and to be more efficient in how it reaches folks and supports their training needs, both internal and perhaps more importantly external to the organization. So there are a number of strategies that help a training system grow and develop to a more mature state. But of course, as we've said, life can change, resources change. I know right now a lot of states are grappling with cuts in budgets and resources, and so training system might find itself back at an earlier stage and back at a place where it needs to move again through a series of innovations and grow back to a truly more effective and mature state. So I think that wraps up what I wanted to say about how an organization, what an effective system looks like, what it does for the folks that it interacts with, and how it can support them, and how it can look internal to itself, its own structure as a system, to find ways to develop and grow from somewhat of a not unstable, but not necessarily quite stable enough system to being a full partner with the rest of the systems in the organization.
Thank you, Susan. Early in the guide, there is a depiction of what Susan said. And as they say, a picture has, what is it, a million words?
Yes.
But on what in my guide is on page 2, there is a picture of an effective training system in child welfare agencies that looks at some of the inputs that Susan talked about, the outputs and the outcomes, and highlights some of the growth strategies. So I think that's a really nice summary for those of you who are thinking about what we're talking about and want to present it either to your leadership or your colleagues or talk about it with folks in your unit. I think going through it the way Susan did is extraordinarily helpful, and then also showing the picture for those who do it that way too. So thank you, Susan. That was like 2.5 years worth of work summarized in about 20 minutes. So that was great. Lori, are you ready to go?
I am ready to go.
Thank you. Let me turn it over to you then.
Well, hello, everyone. My name is Lori Herz, and as Susan mentioned, I am the example of the evolution of a training system depicting Rhode Island's training system. My intent for my part of the discussion is to kind of follow a training system catalyst event timeline that Susan has put up on the NRCOI website. Perhaps some of you have downloaded that. I mainly established that as a means for me to go back in time and to help me to guide our discussion today. But my intent is to, along the way, highlight the changes in our training structure and content, as well as discuss some strategies that have helped us to build an effective child welfare training system in Rhode Island. On that, the last thing I'll say about that handout for now is that there is a little blurb about our child welfare agency in Rhode Island. I'm sure that some of you who have been on peer-to-peer training calls with me have heard this spiel before, but basically we do handle training as a child welfare training institute for child welfare, child protection, children's behavioral health, and juvenile corrections staff. So that just gives you a little bit of a context. We have about 750 staff members and 4 regional offices. Okay? All right, I'm going to start what I kind of call the pre-institute time frame, which is from 1985 to 2001. And our child welfare agency in Rhode Island was established actually in 1978. And shortly after that, in 1980, the Rhode Island College School of Social Work, who is our current university partner, was established. At that time, plans called for a child welfare training institute to be attached to the new School of Social Work and funded through Title 20. Unfortunately, because of political disputes at the state level and the block granting of Title 20, that never happened. Following a series of child deaths between 1980 and 1985, the public and legislative outcry fueled the creation of a formal staff development and training division in 1985, which is where I have started the timeline. Initially, the training team consisted of 3 practitioners, a director and 2 trainers, and 1 clerical support staff. Together, they worked to develop and implement core curriculum for social caseworkers, and they were able to conduct a 2-week-long pre-service training program for those caseworkers. Interestingly enough, both Susan and Susan mentioned that the focus of early child welfare training was on frontline staff, and I can say for sure that bore out here. We were able to put, at the time, everybody in the agency who met that criteria through what they called the pre-service training program, or core training, as it really was known. And then beyond that, we really didn't have a lot of funding because of limited budgets for ongoing training or for training for other direct line staff or other folks in the agency. So there were some classes offered, but not a lot at that time. Our current training director, whose name is Bruce Rollins, took over in 1988, and he's been with us ever since. Originally, he reported to the agency's chief financial officer, and then in about 1990, he reported to one of the other agency's senior leaders. So right from the beginning of his tenure here, he was a member of the agency's leadership team, which is one of the key strategies that we've been talking about so far today. The key leadership team here is made up of program managers and division chiefs. The training unit has always had dedicated training space, which is something that's very, very helpful, as I'm sure many of you know, albeit the training space was typically in the basement of a building with bugs and plumbing issues, but at least we had it to ourselves, so that was a nice thing. At the time, the funding stream was primarily state money and Title 20. Training always had the ability to hire outside contractors, but until the creation of a training contract with our University of Rhode Island Center for Human Services, we had to create a separate contract for each trainer, which was a very tedious, time-consuming process that resulted in the loss of some contracted trainers because of the extensive delay in payment. When that URI training contract was created, it provided us with basically a lump sum of money that was dedicated to paying for outside contractors, so that really streamlined the payroll process for us. Besides the establishment of the staff development and training unit and the creation of the training contract that I just mentioned, the dedicated training space and the direct link between training and senior leadership, another event that impacted our unit was the 1990 legislative mandate of 20 hours of training annually for all agency employees. To meet that demand, the training director added 2 additional clinical training specialists to the training team, and the agency and the training director worked to establish standards for requesting attendance at training, for curriculum, for co-sponsorship of conferences, for attendance at conferences, and for in-house trainers. These standards are actually still part of our agency policy, and I'll talk a little bit later about how we're working on creating even additional standards around the areas of curriculum and trainers and evaluation. Another event that really impacted our training system was the relocation of staff to regional offices in 1995. Prior to that, all agency personnel, with a few exceptions, were located on the Rhode Island College campus, kind of clustered together in 10 buildings within walking distance of each other. That location was selected for two reasons. One, it was the only space available at the time, and two, the rent was free. Training was very convenient prior to regionalization for us and for the participants. Staff could attend to the crises that arose easily while in training because of their close proximity to the office, and the training unit could even walk the training flyers around to each building. People were able to stop in and register in person for a class, but now that we have regionalized the staff, staff need to travel to training, which I'm sure will crack you up when I tell you that in our small state, really nobody has to travel more than 45 minutes to get to training. So it's not as impactful, if you will, as in other states, larger states. But still, for our staff here, it was still a big change for them. They, when they come to training now, they don't have ready access to their office, and we used to have people register by phone at that point. Before the technology revolution, which occurred in 1997, the training secretary had to send flyers through interoffice mail, which was, as you can imagine, not the most efficient delivery method. We would get complaints a lot that staff didn't get a training flyer in time to register for class, or perhaps that they didn't get one at all. And then there was the technology revolution in 1997. The implementation of our SACWIS system in 97 greatly impacted the training unit. We were charged with leading an agency-wide training effort that represented a complete change in the way staff accessed and documented information. Prior to SACWIS, clerical staff were primarily responsible for inputting data and typing case notes and letters and all that kind of documentation. But with SACWIS, all staff were given a computer and expected to use it for documentation. In addition, email was born as a means of communication. According to our training director, we would not have been able to meet the training needs around SACWIS and technology without the URI training contract, so thank God we had that in place. In fact, the contract was expanded to accommodate the hiring of a team of 8 to 10 outside contractors to conduct this implementation training. The implementation training team was initially contracted for 3 months, and then a few of them were asked to stay on to provide on-site support. We initially thought that technology training and support would last for about a year, but we quickly discovered that it was an ongoing need, as was the need to continually upgrade our SACWIS system. Two trainers from the original implementation team were contracted full-time to support that ongoing need. In addition to contracting trainers, the training unit relied heavily on its partnership with our MIS division, Management Information Systems, to support this technology revolution. That partnership continues today. One area that we haven't maybe felt the need, as some of you others might, to grow, but we have our eye on for the future, is e-learning opportunities. This is something that we haven't been pushed to do that much in our small state, but something that we realize is the wave of the future and something that we are intending to incorporate in our curriculum. So that's, you know, something, again, that we're hoping to do in the future, but we don't do a lot of it yet. Okay, as you might imagine, resistance to the technology revolution was widespread within the agency during those early years. Staff didn't feel confident in the system or the data it contained, and supervisors and administrators at the time had a really hard time holding staff accountable because they weren't yet seeing the benefits of the technology. And then in 1999, one of our casework supervisors went to a conference presentation given by our very own Susan Kinnack and the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement about a curriculum geared towards supervisors and their use of data. That supervisor shared the curriculum with me, and we applied and were accepted to be one of 5 pilot states for the Using Information Management to Support the Goals of Safety, Permanency, and Well-Being curriculum. We piloted that curriculum in 2000. This project served as a catalyst for the creation of many new reports and highlighted the need to break data down to the unit and even individual worker level in order for it to be useful to line supervisors. Staff began to see the benefits of the technology, which in turn prompted them to input data in a more timely and accurate fashion, which in turn made the data more reliable for decision-making and reporting. It was also the beginning of a partnership that over the years has put us in touch with best practices and curriculum from around the country and given us access to expertise that has helped us to become more of a proactive partner to our child welfare agency. That partnership that I'm talking about is with the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement. Another example of how that partnership has impacted us is in 2004, I believe it was, we piloted the first version of our training system assessment, which was mentioned already today. And we did that agency-wide, and we learned that despite the organizational chart type of connection, that connection between training and leadership, there was quite a disconnect in terms of our training content and the strategic impact our training has on organizational change. We needed to better communicate our value and educate the agency leadership about our programs, and in turn, we needed to make more efforts to involve them in our strategic planning. The National Resource Center and our regional ACF office led a planning retreat for us to strategize how to partner better with agency leadership. We've since implemented many of these strategies effectively. For example, our agency director meets with our new workers monthly and with training staff quarterly. Our policy division has co-trained with us on a couple of initiatives. We collaborate with agency personnel on grant applications, and we participate on the agency's internal quality assurance reviews. And we also make sure that training is at the table for most, if not all, change initiatives. We also continue to work with the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement on training system projects, most recently on the creation of training standards for curriculum development that I mentioned earlier, for trainers, for evaluation, and we are also working to revamp the policy that's in place right now, the standards that are in place right now that I talked about before for trainees. So in many ways, our partnership with the National Resource Center and ACF has helped us to become more proactive as a training system. Now I'm going to shift phase to sort of post-institute and talk about the formation of the Child Welfare Institute, which occurred in June of 2001, and I'll take us through the present. This is obviously another key event for our division. As you may recall, the notion of Child Welfare Institute attached to the Rhode Island School of Social Work had been floating around since about 1980 because child welfare professionals realized even back then how beneficial this type of partnership would be to child welfare in Rhode Island. Sadly, though, a child death in 1998 brought the creation of a Child Welfare Institute to the forefront again, and our training director should be applauded for keeping this dream alive and bringing it to fruition. This university partnership has many benefits for us. We are able to access more funding opportunities, such as Title IV-E reimbursement, for a percentage of participant and training staff salaries while involved in training activities covered by 4E. We benefit by the ability to apply for grant opportunities more readily because the college has a license to file grant applications electronically while our child welfare agency does not. And the more obvious opportunity and benefit is to link theory with practice and to access the expertise of faculty in curriculum development, research, grant writing, and evaluation. We realized these benefits almost right away when we expanded our existing caseworker pre-service training program from 1 month to 6 months. We all felt that a longer pre-service program would provide multiple opportunities for staff evaluation, greater collaboration between training, academia, and the field, and the ability to gradually assign cases to new workers, all of which enhanced transfer of learning and better prepared our direct line staff for their tough jobs. This initiative was an exciting and crazy time for us in training because we only had 2 months to prepare for our first class of new caseworkers after officially becoming an institute. To date, we have graduated 10 cohorts of caseworkers, and we are 4 months into our program with class 11. We absolutely could not have done it or continue to run the program today without the help of our partners internally and externally. Our internal partners include our practice system, you know, our practitioners, our supervisors, our administrators, our workers, our policy system, our MIS system, our academic faculty partners, and human resources. In addition, we formed an advisory board consisting of political, academic, and child welfare system community representatives, which provided oversight during the early institute years. This board has since been disbanded because their role has become less critical as a whole, although some of the community partnerships that were born from this process have continued to thrive. After successfully implementing our expanded pre-service program for caseworkers, the Institute was asked by the agency administration to lead the implementation of our practice model, which is based on, as we've already talked about today, family-centered practice principles. Like the technology revolution, this was an agency-wide and ultimately a child welfare system-wide initiative. We again engaged the expertise and help of ACF and the National Resource Center for Family-Centered Practice and Permanency Planning, and together we developed a curriculum and led a demonstration project that involved partnerships with not only agency practitioners, but community practitioners and social work academics. The demonstration project spanned a full 18 months, and shortly thereafter, our practice model was implemented agency-wide. Like many changes, this one was met with some resistance, and it has taken years of consistent communication, training, SACWIS system changes, policy changes, you name it, to fully implement internally. Our work in making this practice change system-wide continues today with our external partners. We currently offer general training on family-centered practice and specific training on visitation, engaging fathers, engaging incarcerated parents, and very recently we started to offer supervisory training to our community partners. What makes this training especially effective is the collaborative co-training model that we follow, where we pair up institute staff with community and, at times, correctional staff to conduct the training. Another catalyst event for our training system and further proof that we were headed in the right direction was the CFSR. In 2002, we were one of the last states to participate in a pilot CFSR, which helped us to prepare for CFSR Round 1, which happened for us in 2004, I believe. Training did quite well in both the pilot CFSR and Round 1, particularly our new pre-service program and our Engaging Fathers training programs. Of course, there were also a few areas needing improvement, most notably the lack of a structured ongoing training program for caseworkers and the lack of core training programs for supervisors and direct line staff other than family services caseworkers. The agency, not necessarily training, but of course it impacted us, was also cited for not consistently engaging fathers in permanency planning and for not consistently engaging children, parents, and siblings in face-to-face visitation, as our policy states. Around the same time, we unfortunately had another child death. So since then, the program improvement plan and recommendations born from the child advocate's investigation into that child's death has prioritized and shaped our work. We have created structured core curriculum at levels 1, 2, and in some cases 3 for direct line staff and supervisors. We've incorporated an individual training needs assessment into our core 1 and 2 programs for family services caseworker staff, which is a training planning tool. We have incorporated the agency's practice model into all of our curriculum, which started obviously back when we implemented our practice model but continues today. We've partnered with the community on a number of training initiatives, some of which I have mentioned, and we've included the Child Advocate's Office in our Core 1 pre-service training program. The Child Advocate and perhaps some of her staff come to do a presentation for our new workers and talk to them about the impact of their work in the child welfare community. We've partnered internally with Policy Practice and MIS, and externally with national resource centers to develop a new risk and protective capacity assessment and service plan that truly links risk factors with interventions. The agency has also formed a case monitoring unit, which arranges and tracks in-home intensive services to prevent the removal of children from home whenever possible and safe. and a permanency planning team made up of community and agency staff, which is in place to help workers uncover permanency resources. For our training system, I would say in Rhode Island, the CFSR and the PIP has really helped us to prioritize our work. It has enhanced the validity of our work. It's provided us with performance feedback, and in some senses, it has fueled our growth. It also has brought to the forefront the importance of creating and maintaining partnerships, both internally and externally, which we found to be a key strategy mentioned by many of our advisors during the development of this guide and certainly bears out for us. Okay, let's talk about our future just for a minute. Our future as a training system will absolutely include more work in the community because the agency and our external partners are in the process of implementing a system of care reorganization. At the same time, as we've heard, we are being asked to do more with less, as our state and many others are faced with a budget crisis. We have begun to diversify our funding sources as a proactive strategy to that. For example, when we anticipated that our URI training contract would take a hit for this year and definitely for the next fiscal year, we have begun to cultivate more internal training resources. We have always included in-house experts in our training efforts, but their involvement is even more critical now. We are also calling upon our partners in academia and in the community to kind of swap expertise with us. For example, we'll train your staff on this, or present to your class on this if you'll train our staff on that. And we are seeking grant funding from a wider variety of sources than ever before. These funding strategies and the other strategies I've mentioned throughout my discussion should help us to remain viable and effective long into the future. At this time, I would like to thank all of you for indulging me in this walk down memory lane, and I hope that you find our discussion today and in particular our training guide helpful in your efforts to build an effective training system. And Susan Kanak, I guess I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Lori. That was really wonderful, and I really appreciate all of the times that you mentioned the work that you do with the other people in the agency and also the resource centers, because that leads me right into what I want to talk about just for a minute before we open up the line for questions and answers. That was great, Lori. Thank you. I know we want to get into the Q&A portion of this call, but before we do, I want to mention the technical assistance available through the Children's Bureau. If you go to our website, which is www.nrcoi.org, you'll see on the homepage a link to the Children's Bureau Training and Technical Assistance Network, which is comprised of several agencies that are designed to help build the capacity of state, local, tribal, and other publicly administered or supported child welfare agencies to achieve safety, permanency, and well-being. Lori actually did most of my work, so I'm not going to repeat it, but the NRCOI has focused on supporting training systems for the last 8 to 10 years, and we offer a variety of opportunities for you to become engaged and involved in talking with your peers across the country, and also to be involved in calls of this type. And we're also available to come down and do some work with you around facilitating development of training system standards or even, and we hope to do this work with many of you on this call, thinking through how you would assess your training system and help it grow and move into the next phase. So check out our website, talk to Lori and others across the country, and you'll hear the type of resources that we can help you locate and identify. So with that said, let me open the lines, and I think we've got about 15 minutes left for your questions, comments. We'd love to hear your feedback on the guide, the conversation today, and would love to know how you were thinking about your training system as we were talking about the Rhode Island one and Susan was walking you through the performance principles. How does yours rate? So do we have questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. Again, if you have a question, please press one key on your touch-tone telephone. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Beverly Watkins. Your line is open.
Okay. I would like to ask, I believe the last speaker, when she was talking about the Rhode Island experience, she talked about grant funding was being sought from a variety of sources, and I wondered if she could elaborate on what those sources were and, you know, how that whole thing worked out, or if that's something that they're just doing. I wasn't clear on whether that's something outside funding is something they're seeking at this time or if that's been part of the program all along.
Hi, Beverly. Thanks for your question. It is something that is more recent than the norm.
Okay.
When I talk about a variety of resources, I'm talking about local, national, federal, state, business interests. For example, we recently have partnered with a foundation born from really it was a family, and it's called the Ninas Foundation, and they, instead of divvying up the money inherited from Nina, their mother, what they did is they created this foundation. And the foundation is to help child welfare meet the needs of families in this state. And so the project that one of my colleagues has started on is creating a visitation center called the Ninas Visitation Center. And it's really to help create a home-based like environment for visitation. And we, you know, the center is actually going to be located at our college campus, ironically, in what we call the Yellow Cottage, which was part of, prior to the 1978 creation of the Rhode Island Department of Children, Youth, and Families, it was the what they called the state home and school. Okay?
Okay.
So that building has been partially refurbished by the college as a historical, you know, building, but they're going to be using that building and continuing the construction so that they can make it into a visitation center. So that's one example of, when I say a variety of sources, that we were fortunate enough to partner with.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking for more and more of those types of, you know, opportunities.
Right. So you have a grant writer that probably pursues those opportunities for you, or how does that whole thing work?
Well, that's also a very interesting question. I would consider, and I really didn't say this while I was doing my talk, but I would consider us to be in a growth phase of our life cycle.
Uh-huh.
So I think that as one of our strategies, we're trying to diversify our funding sources. And thankfully, because we have access to grant writers who work for our university partner,
uh-huh.
Actually, both university partners, if you will, because we consider the University of Rhode Island to be a partner that I mentioned holds our training contract.
Uh-huh.
We can hire outside trainers, and we consider our School of Social Work at Rhode Island College to be our university partner. So
uh-huh.
really we have two resources there. We also have one woman in particular who works for our agency, our state agency, Child Welfare Agency, and she also is heavily involved in grant writing.
Okay.
So we kind of partner with a variety of people depending on what the grant is and their interest and their area of expertise.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Richard Dean. Your line is open.
Hello, Susan. This is Dick Dean from Minnesota. And my question is, how do we go about getting on-site assistance for some of the things that I've heard discussed today? Specifically, we're looking at making some changes in our training system to tie it in even more closely, because I think we're tied in fairly closely with the whole CFSR process, but also to look at making our system more effective.
That's a great question, Dick, and I'm so glad you asked it. One of the things to do, one way you could start is by giving me a call or sending me an email, and this is Susan Kanak, and
right.
I'm on the website. And we can start a conversation about what the needs are that you've identified and what would be ways that either we could help you or help you contact peers across the country that could give you some support and advice on the particular issues that you have. Once we've had an initial conversation, you would talk within your agency to the director or whoever has contact with the federal regional office, and we would make an official, you could make an official request to the regional office for some on-site, what's called TNTA, Training and Technical Assistance, from the Resource Center. The regional office would approve that or ask some questions and would put together a work plan for what we could do, what you would be doing, and set out a timeline. And that is, the process is as simple or complicated as that, but it involves a lot of back and forth conversations, identification of needs, and then identification of resources to help you address those needs.
In that process, do you work also then with the regional office? Does it become kind of a three-way conversation, or is it just a two-way with you and then a two-way with them?
That varies among the regional offices. They certainly are all always involved in talking about every request for on-site technical assistance before it happens. They're involved at that point, and they review the requests and talk with all the three of us get together and talk about what the outcomes are going to be, how the outcomes of this technical assistance are going to help improve the training system and improve the work of the agency. In some cases, as Lori mentioned, the regional office actually hosted the visit where we went down from this resource center and met with the folks from Rhode Island in the Boston regional office, and they were heavily involved there. In other cases, they do some conversations with us over the phone before the on-site visit so we can be really clear about what they'd like to also see as an outcome. And then we always follow up with them after the visit has occurred to let them know how we think it went. So there's a variety of ways the regional offices can be involved, and we always welcome and encourage their involvement.
Okie doke. Really good.
Look forward to hearing from you, Dick.
I'm sure you will be.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Ashley Seabrook. Your line is open. Ashley?
Thank you. This is Ashley. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. I come from Colorado, and my question is regarding the statement that I heard a couple of different times about the training director must be viewed as a member of the leadership team. And my question is, What would be the reason for that? I mean, I guess I get it on my own level, but what would be your argument for what might happen if they're not a part of the leadership team?
Hi, that's a great question, Ashley, because I know people struggle with, or some training directors struggle with getting themselves into that level of conversation. From our perspective, the reason for the training director to be engaged at that level of the organization so that they can be thinking proactively and strategically about training on behalf of the organization. And so as the senior leadership team is deliberating its general strategy or specific responses to particular challenges or opportunities, it's important for the training director to be there at the beginning of those conversations so that they can anticipate what kinds of training needs the agency will want to have met in order to successfully pursue a particular strategy. I'm sure you've had the experience, I've had the experience of long deliberations occur about strategy or a particular program, and once those decisions are made, it's hurry up, get the training curriculum done in 2 weeks, get the funding figured out in 2 days, you know, find all the logistics out in, 3 hours and go.
Right.
So all of that undermines effective training and undermines any kind of effective operation of any kind, not just training. And so, but it's the nature our business, I think, that things happen that way. And so rather than thinking that it won't happen that way ever again, have the training director there at the table from the get-go so that they can be thinking all along about whether or not they have a resource currently that meets the need, whether they have a resource that can be reprogrammed or redirected, or whether they might need to get new resources in order to figure out how to support the agency's overall strategy or particular focused intervention of a particular kind. And so being at the table is important.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a question from Lynn Kelt. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Lynn Kelts from the Pennsylvania Child Welfare Training Program, and we provide the mandated training for caseworkers and supervisors as well as some leadership academy training. I think we're a mature system, but in the 4 years I've been here, we're constantly changing and growing too. My question is, have you found other states that also offer technical assistance in addition to the training? We offer TA to the 67 counties who provide child welfare services in the state at their request. And we're always looking for colleagues and peers with whom we can share experiences and learning. Have you found other states that are doing this, other training programs that are doing this?
This is Susan Kanak, and I'll take a shot at that. And if there's someone on the line whose state is doing that very intensively, please rapidly push your button to let us know. From my scan of the training systems across the country, Pennsylvania is the leader in building that, I think you call it organizational effectiveness, capacity into the training unit. Other states have done it somewhat less comprehensively, perhaps more. I know for some states what they do is they have they're beginning to identify the needs of a particular area or region based on an internal QI, QA review, and they can send some trainers out occasionally to do some on-site stuff specific to those needs. And I know Kentucky did a lot with specific mentoring of areas and regions based on identified needs. And Maine does some of that also, but in terms of the comprehensive approach that Pennsylvania has taken, I believe, congratulations, you are the national leader. And again, if some other state is doing it that comprehensively, I'd love to know about it. So thank you for the question.
Well, thank you, Sue. Just keep us in mind if you hear of anybody then.
We will. We often send people to you so you can help them understand how to do this. But I will, as I hear of other states growing their capacity to do this, try to link you together.
Thank you.
We have a question from Amy Mobley. I'm sorry, Amy Mobley.
Yes.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay. I work with Georgia Department of Family and Children Services, and I work with the Professional Excellence Program through the Georgia State University School of Social Work that partners with the Department of Family and Children Services. And we develop veteran worker training for our case managers and supervisors. But I am finding that we'll start creating a curriculum, and then we'll find out that there's curriculums all around the United States. And sometimes some of these curriculums are copyrighted. And so my question is there a certain resource you can go to? I know the information gateway is helpful, but it would be nice if there was some type of a group of people that you can contact to talk about curriculums that you can share back and forth. Do you know of any resource like that?
That's a great question, and I hear it over and over and over again. The Information Gateway is the best that we know of at this point, and they are really so much stronger than they were a few years ago in terms of setting out curriculum and sharing it with folks, and they are getting even better at it. So I would keep an eye on their development. The Peer Training Network that is sponsored by NRCOI is also another place where folks have begun to share curriculum. Amy, I believe you've recently joined that network, and what you'll see is I often get requests from states that say, I'm looking for curriculum. Recently we had one from Arizona who was looking for training for their mid-managers, and so I shoot an email out to, you know, over 200 people across the country and say, does anybody have any curriculum that they can share with Arizona, in this case, that they've used for effectively training their managers? And we'll find sometimes there's really good curricula to share. Sometimes there's really not much out there. But that's another vehicle that has been used to kind of help people not reinvent the wheel, because I think you're right on in terms of the concept that a lot of people are focusing a lot of time developing excellent training curriculum in areas where other people have also spent that time. So the more we can do to share, to go to conferences, to be willing to talk about what we've done and give it away to other people, the better off we all will be.
All right, thank you.
And I would absolutely mirror what you say. This is Lori from Rhode Island again. I've been on the Peer-to-Peer Training Network for, well, a few years now, I guess, Susan. And I have, you know, been opened up to a wealth of resources through that vehicle. So I would absolutely say that that's a great place to start.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. We have a question from Vernon Simmons. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm Vernon Simmons. I'm with the Division of Family Services and Social Services in Virginia. And I guess my question is for Lori in Rhode Island. I'm really interested in your statement that your advisory board has disbanded.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you can speak to what the good parts about that are and what the not-so-good parts about that are.
Okay. well, the advisory board, as I mentioned, was pulled together to help provide some kind of oversight and direction for the Child Welfare Institute when we formed in 2001. And we had a number of a good variety of people on the team. I believe there were about, I want to say about 15 people at one point. And what we found is that initially when we were forming the Institute, they were very, very helpful in helping us to shape what we would and what we wouldn't be able to respond to in terms of training needs. They were helpful in terms of, you know, how we should structure our training system. And then as we sort of got underway and we got heavily involved in one particular project, which was really expanding our caseworker, new hire caseworker training program, I think some of the folks felt, well, you know, this isn't really my area of expertise. I'm not a curriculum developer. In some cases, perhaps, you know, they haven't really had their hand in a lot of training-related activities. So they kind of felt, well, you know, keep me posted, but you know, it's not really something I want to spend once a month, you know, talking about. So that's just being very frank about it.
Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I show no more questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone. As we're wrapping up the call, let me remind you to please fill out your evaluations. We do look at them, and we take your feedback seriously, and so I would ask you to take a couple of minutes to do that. It's extremely helpful to us as a resource center in shaping future teleconferences, shaping future possible newsletters and or areas that we're going to spend our time. So please do that. Remember, you can obtain audio files of this teleconference and others in the NRCOI teleconference series. Check our website, again, for the third time, www.nrcoi.org. for information on how to obtain the audio files. You can actually download them. They'll be out there in a day or two. And just to let you know, this is the final teleconference in our 2008 spring teleconference series. Be sure to keep an eye on our website, though, because we are in the middle now of planning our fall teleconference series, and we've got some really excellent topics that are going to be coming up, and I'm sure you'll find them informative. So let me take a minute to thank Susan and Lori. It's been a fabulous call. I also want to again thank all of you, the participants, and especially those of you who contributed to educating Susan, Lori, Maureen, and I as we were in the process of updating and creating this training system assessment guide. We learned a lot from you, and it's our pleasure to be able to feed it back and share it with folks across the country. So thank you very much. As always, you're so generous with your advice and expertise. Thanks very much. I hope everyone has a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lori, can you stay on?
Yeah.
What's your number, Lori? I'm going to give you a call.
Okay, I'm at my work, 401.
Yeah.
456.
Yeah.
4621.
I'll buzz you right now.
All right. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation, and have a wonderful day. You may all disconnect.